I just make your point.
Okay. Call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order, and let the record reflect that the time is currently 3:45 p.m. on Thursday, April 27th, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Gren, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And if folks can mute their cell phones, at this meeting, we will be hearing HB 159, the Opioids Prescriptions Database and Licenses Bill. We were going to have our second hearing on HB 25, the Insurance Coverage for Contraceptives Bill, but due to floor going long today, we're going to have a change up in how we do this today. We're going to, we had Mr. Butler fly in, and so we'd like him to present on HB 159, and so if you could please come to the table, and he, if you could put yourself on the record, and unfortunately, we've got a alleged council meeting that starts in here at 4:15. It's supposed to start at 4, but they've said that we can go till 4:15. So we'll go as long as we can with you, Mr. Butler, here. And then, so with that, if you could put yourself on the record, and thank you for being here.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, everybody. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for this chance to present to you HB 159. I think everyone's aware that the opioid epidemic continues. In 2006, over 90 of our fellow Alaskans died of an opioid overdose. That's nearly three times the number of Alaskans who died of AIDS at the peak of the HIV epidemic. This represents nearly one in every 40 deaths that occurred in Alaska last year, and oftentimes these deaths occur among our young people. Two-thirds of these deaths involved a prescription opioid painkiller, and the majority of people who use heroin or synthetic opioids report that they started and became hooked using prescription opioids, oftentimes taken on the advice of a trusted healthcare provider and a well-meaning healthcare provider, I would want to add and emphasize. Alaska is responding through community coalitions and even through state government. SB 91 authorized increased access to the life-saving drug naloxone, and with federal funds, it made possible for us to be able to provide these rescue kits. We've now distributed nearly 5,000 of these around the state, and I'm very pleased to say that now in the public health centers, we have staff that have received the train-the-trainer information so that they can also be able to distribute these kits locally to people and save lives. And we have a number of reports of people who have been able to be revived using the kits. While the kits can save a life, they really don't solve the problem. They do not support people in recovery who desperately want to continue to live in sobriety, and they don't address the underlying drivers that increase the risk of opioid misuse and addiction. HB 159 adds to the state's multifaceted approach to addressing the epidemic, and it aligns with many of the recommendations of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as the recent report from the U.S. Surgeon General, as well as a number of medical professional societies, as well as some of the best practices that have been developed and adopted through the VA system. So, to give you an overview of the bill, HB 159 can be viewed as addressing three areas. As a mnemonic, I think of it as the three P's: patients, providers, and the prescription drug monitoring program. Regarding patients, there's two aspects. First, the bill provides for an opioid advance directive as a communication tool between patients and a provider that can be included in the medical record. The directive makes it clear that a patient does not wish to receive opioid medications. The directive is purely voluntary and is revocable. As a provider, I have to say I might not have thought that this was necessary, but as I've talked to a number of people in recovery, as well as their families, they have expressed concern that too many providers don't fully understand the destructive effects of opioids for some people. For some, they're the wrong drug at any time, at any dose. The bill provides for a waiver of civil liability if an opioid is withheld when a directive is in place, and also if an opioid is inadvertently administered when a directive is in place, as might occur during an emergency situation. The second aspect for patients, the bill provides in state statute the authority for a patient to be able to request a partial fill of an opioid prescription if they wish to receive a smaller number of pills, and it reinforces the authority of the pharmacist to be able to honor the partial fill request without immediately voiding the remaining portion of the prescriptions. And this matches then with the federal authority under CARA, the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act of 2016. Regarding providers, again, two aspects. First, an analysis of data that was released earlier this year shows that persons who receive larger first-time supplies of opioids are more likely to be chronic opioid users and at greater risk of dependency and addiction a year later. This risk increases particularly for first-time prescriptions that are more than about 5 to 7 days in length. Recently, we reviewed the Alaska Medicaid claims from last year and found that roughly half of all first-time opioid prescriptions were for supplies of 15 days or longer. Even if the drugs are not used, they can become a source of diversion and misuse in the community. Another review published just this month in the Annals of Surgery showed that nearly three-fourths of all the opioids prescribed to patients being discharged from a hospital at the time of surgery go unused. Therefore, HB 159 proposes that first-time prescriptions for acute pain be limited to no more than a 7-day supply to define a safer standard of care. And this aligns with the CDC recommendations for pain management, which recommends in general a 3-day or supply less or less supply be prescribed, but points out that more than 7 days is really an unusual indication. Recognizing that opioids are appropriate for treatment of some conditions, the limit is waived for severe acute pain, chronic pain, cancer pain, palliative care, or situations where travel logistics would make it difficult to potentially get a refill or to see a provider. The reason for dispensing more than a 7-day supply would be documented in the medical record. There's no intention of limiting the access to care, but this does provide a stop check for the provider to consider how much of the medication is really needed for a given patient and have it documented in the medical record. I continue to hear stories from Alaskans, and one that I caught my attention about a month ago was a school nurse describing how one of their students who had had an orthopedic procedure, a fairly minor procedure in fact, came to school the next day and, as was required, turned in his prescription medications and had 120 Vicodins. There really is no indication for that. So what I hope this would do is that provider would stop and consider, does this patient need this many pills? The second provision for providers is the bill authorizes the professional boards to require part of the currently required continuing education credit be designated to education in pain management or basics of addiction medicine. For example, as a physician, every time I renew my medical license every other year, I have to provide documentation that I've received 40 hours of continuing medical education credit, and the bill would require that at least 2 of those hours be dedicated to either pain management or addiction medicine. It's important to recognize that even though this is part of an opioid bill, the challenges with substance misuse and addiction are much larger. There's a similar number of Alaskans who have a substance use disorder as the number of Alaskans who have diabetes. It's important that all providers understand the basics and basic fundamentals of both of these common chronic conditions, yet many more understand diabetes than are aware of the special needs of persons in recovery or how to approach the patient who's struggling with addiction or a substance use disorder. The science of treating substance use dependency and addiction is evolving fast. And this has been an area of medicine that too many of us have ignored. And I'll be among the first to say that I certainly ignored it for a number of years, despite the fact that as an infectious disease provider, I was taking care of a number of self-injection drug users. And there's plenty of good, free, online continuing medical education courses available. For example, the American Medical Association has produced a fabulous CME module that's entitled A Primer on Opioid Mortality and Morbidity, What Every Prescriber Needs to Know. I think it's worth noting that this doesn't just say what every pain physician needs to know, what every ER doc needs to know, not just what the other guy needs to know, but what every prescriber needs to know. The CDC has also produced a number of materials in collaboration with the UW Pain Clinic that is also available online and includes some of the questions that I hear from providers that are most challenging, such as, what do I do with the patient that has chronic pain and has been on opioids for years? It's not controlling the pain. They want increasing doses, and I really worry about this patient's safety. Some of the CME modules even provide specialty maintenance of certification credit, making it the training a twofer. But they're really, I believe, underused. And let me stress again that many of the options that are available are free. The third P is the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. I think as I said to this committee last year, the PDMP is not a panacea. But it can be a useful clinical tool, although it's a tool that only does the job if it's actually used. I have to admit I'm not a natural fan to PDMP. It's another step in the process of patient care. But I've been impressed as I've talked to some of my colleagues who've begun to use it that they have learned things that they did not know about how to best take care of their patients. There's also emerging data that's showing that in states that have had the required mandate to use the PDMP, there's been about a 10% decline in Medicaid expenditures related to opioid medications. So the three aspects of the PDMP, and I will move as quick as possible, Mr. Chairman, thank you. It authorizes the Department of Commerce to issue regular unsolicited reports to prescribers, sometimes called report cards. These would be issued to all providers registered in the PDMP, and it would simply provide a non-punitive feedback source for each provider on his or her prescribing practices for opioids and how that compares to that of their peers. In talking with colleagues and thinking about what are some of the things that we need to do to address opioids, this is a concept that was actually suggested to me by some providers as a way to use the PDMP as an educational tool and a self-check, not unlike what's been done in some healthcare organizations to provide feedback on prescribing of antimicrobial drugs to be able to limit unnecessary use of those drugs that can lead to antimicrobial resistance. Roughly 10 states have instituted similar programs. Second aspect of the PDMP depends on timely data. Under SB 74, the reporting interval for pharmacies went from monthly to weekly. HB 159 proposes to further increase the reporting interval to daily, as is already done in 25 other states. We do recognize that this is an administrative burden for some of our valued rural pharmacies who may not be as automated and are still preparing for the advance to weekly updates. So the draft that you have of HB 159 has an implementation date in mid-2018 for advancement to the daily updates to be able to give pharmacies time to be able to get up to speed. And finally, HB 159 clarifies a point that was discussed during the SB 74 hearings last year and clearly defines the role of veterinarians with active DEA numbers and legal and provides and who have legal authority to prescribe opioids, requiring them to register in the PDMP. While I do not know how prevalent the problem is, perhaps you've heard some of the reports from the lower 48 of people who've actually injured animals as a way to go to the veterinarian and try to obtain opioid medications for personal use or for diversion. So the goal of this portion of the bill is to help vets from becoming the go-to for opioids to be misused or diverted. In closing, addressing the opioid epidemic in Alaska is going to take all of us. I'm not here to blame anybody, and I think it's important that we don't go down that road, that we have to all own the problem and address it. Congressman Hal Rogers from Kentucky, chair of the House Appropriations Committee, I thought was a lawmaker that really has struggled with this and said it well when he said, "No silver bullet exists to stem the tide of prescription drug abuse in America. The lack of an easy solution requires all of us to treat the opioid crisis as a nonpartisan issue and adopt an all-hands-on-deck approach." I believe HP 159 is part of Alaska's call for all hands on deck to help support our fellow Alaskans living in recovery and reduce the number of persons who become newly dependent on these medications while protecting the care of those who truly need them. Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to take questions. I also have Assistant Attorney General Stacey Crayley with me, as well as Sarah Chambers from Department of Commerce. I may ask them to join me if time permits and if needed for the questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Butler. We do have another 15 minutes for questions, so I think we're doing okay. If we have extra time, we have one person on the off-net for public testimony, but we do have to be out of here at 4:15, so it's possible that that may get pushed off later. But does the committee have any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Butler, I gave you a copy of some questions. One of the things is, and the members have a copy of the CDC recommendations, and I'm somewhat worried about the seven-day time limit, because when you put a time limit in, people think that's what they should prescribe. And the CDC is saying that 3 days or less is often sufficient for acute pain, and that more than 7 days will rarely be needed. So how would you feel about having some intent language in the bill that says that although there's a 7 days maximum, that that should not be considered a standard, that it should be, you know, people should err on the side of the lower limit if it seems to be needed, or the lower 3 days if that would seem to be sufficient.
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chairman, through the chair, I think that's a very reasonable idea, because it would not define that prescriptively, but certainly would reiterate the intent of the bill to keep the dose low and the amount of pills as small as possible to meet the clinical needs, and it provides the flexibility for the professional judgment of the provider.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. I also want to note, soon after we started, we were also joined by Representatives Thompson, Tilton, and Wilson. And with that, we've got a question from Representative Wilson, and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it almost feels like we're trying to play doctor here. I mean, if somebody is giving 120 pills at one time, I don't think we need a bill for that. That seems like that should break rules somewhere. So it seems like what this bill is saying, that by controlling what doctors give or how much they give, will cure this whole issue. It's, and that's the only place that people are getting this drug. So is that what you're trying to say?
Representative Wilson, thank you for that question through the chair. No, absolutely not. First of all, I don't think it's the role of government to dictate how medicine is practiced, but I do think there is a role for us to define some parameters, and sometimes that may actually require definition in statute to be able to address that challenge of the large numbers of pills that are sometimes dispensed. I think it's also just as is already done by the fact that we have a medical board and a nursing board and a pharmacy board that issues licenses and oversees the quality of care, there are times where we have to help redefine and direct what is the standard of care. We certainly do medicine differently now than we did 100 years ago. Where we are in 2017 is a little different place than we were in 1997. And particularly when it comes to pain management, there clearly needs to be some sort of check. We, from the period of about 1995 through 2010 as a nation, started prescribing fourfold the number of opioids. We saw a fourfold increase in overdose deaths. Yet despite that, there's no evidence that there was a decline in chronic pain. So we were doing something with the goal of an outcome that we didn't achieve with clearly adverse effects.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
I don't have a problem that there's a standard of care. I guess my issue is why government's making that standard of care. I mean, physicians go a long time to school and have to, from what you just said, too, they have to have so many hours of continuing education. So are we really making these rules for doctors who are what you may feel or whoever put this together, and I don't mean any of this personally because I'm not sure who wrote this 50-page bill, but it's almost like we're trying to control those that we think are giving too much, but really all the regulation goes down all the way down the line to even those who are doing best practices, are doing what this bill is trying to do by making it daily, you know, talking about what kind of classes they have to do. So, again, I guess I'm just trying to figure out why the board itself, the physician board or whatever, can't have the regulations and do their own monitoring. And if they have people who are prescribing way too much, why? Because we're actually in the bill, I don't even have some of that. Don't they have a lot of the tools to be able to deal with this?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I think I can best answer the question by quoting a colleague and perhaps also asking Ms. Chambers to join me, since the medical board is in the Department of Commerce, to see if she has any additional comments. But one of my colleagues who objected quite vociferously to some of the measures in SB 74 recently commented to me, you know, it seems like just putting out clinical guidelines isn't changing things fast enough. So I'm not sure. First of all, I want to make it very clear, this is not going to make everything go away, but it is part of how we address the problem. And I think there's two aspects in the practice of medicine where we're not doing everything we should. One is addressing how pain is managed and understanding that opioids are like a third level. If we, for instance, look at the recent guidelines from the American College of Physicians, there is much more emphasis on not only non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, but also some alternative pain management strategies, including massage and physical therapy. Yet too often, it is opioids are the first thing that are used.
And Mr. Chairman, just kind of a question, and I guess I still don't understand why we're managing doctors and doctors aren't managing themselves. But is there going to be a time at some point, because this is a 35-page bill, is anybody planning on having like expert testimony from the, you know, from physicians and how practices maybe have changed? Or I don't think it's so simple that we could just tell doctors what to do or how to prescribe and all of a sudden we're not going to have an issue. But this is way beyond my educational level.
We can certainly reach out to folks, and if you've got any suggestions, we're certainly open to that. So we can work with your office on that.
Thank you.
We've got questions from Representative Guerra, and then Pruitt, and then Ortiz.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Dr. Butler. I guess I would like to get at least a partial solution out as quick as possible, but I would agree that I don't see a full solution here, so I don't want to slow down a partial solution just because nobody has a full one. I've got some questions. So I've had my own experiences with pain, probably not even close to the pain that many, many other people suffer. So I can only use my own experience, broken ribs and back surgeries and things like that. But like Representative Seaton says, I've never had a circumstance in my limited pain experiences to even want more than 3 days worth of this stuff. And so, yeah, it sits in my closet. So why are we? Why wouldn't we have for certain types of pain a 3-day limit that would require a doctor to explain in the chart why they would offer more, why they need to offer more than 3 days if they issue more than 3 days. So 3 days with a presumption of 3 days, but of course a doctor could say under the circumstances of this patient they need 5 or 6 or 7.
Yes. Representative Guerra, through the chair, there really is, I'm not sure quite where the sweet spot is on this, but I think we are trying to provide as much opportunity for the professional judgment of the provider to be able to determine what's the appropriate amount, but also define some guidelines and guardrails, if you will, since this is in statute, that don't currently exist because we do see some very large amounts of opioids are sometimes dispensed. And also just to call attention, in terms of the 7-day limit requiring a documentation in the record, oftentimes what I've heard, and I bet many of us have heard, is, well, just in case you need it, that's probably not a good indication for opioids, just in case, particularly if we're talking about 30 to 50 tablets, such as what I was surprised to find in my own medicine cabinet from when my daughter had some dental work recently. I don't think that's a HIPAA violation, but I hope not.
Well, that's what I meant with the obviously, the doctor is going to know best, but if you had 3 days with an explanation that they needed more, you'd still be giving the discretion to the doctor saying, no, they need more. So I guess I'd ask you that to think about that. But then there's the flip question. I mean, what happens for somebody who doesn't live in a place where there's a drugstore, and so let's say my 3 days or your 5 days is the rule with an allowance of an exception, but then they need to renew. So you live in a place with no drugstore in rural Alaska, off the road system. If this goes into place, how do they get their renewal in time if they need a renewal?
Representative Guerra, thank you for that question through the chair. That actually is an aspect of this bill that I think is fairly unique compared to the language in some other states, and also comparing to the language in Senator McCain's bill that has been introduced in the U.S. Senate, in that it does specifically call out that situation of the rural resident who may have logistical or travel challenges being able to get to a pharmacy as a valid waiver to the 7-day limit.
Through the chair,
Representative Guerra. Unfortunately,
that's fine.
We do have ledge counsel that needs to be in here in 3 minutes. What we will do is either Mr. Butler, if he could make himself self available by telephone, if possible,
great.
At the next time we bring this issue up. I don't know if you also have time. We could make our finance conference room right around the corner here available. I know that Representative Ortiz and Pruitt also had more questions, and so that opportunity is also there. So at this time, we will set the bill aside and bring that back at a future date. Our next regularly scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is at 1:30 p.m. on Friday, April 28th. And at this meeting, we'll be having our first hearings on SB 78, the Permanent Fund Dividend Contributions and Lottery Bill, and also HB 105, the Denali-Wolf Special Management Area Bill. And we'll also be bringing SB 83, an act relating to the protection of vulnerable adults and residents of long-term care facilities, back under bills previously heard. We are also scheduled to hear today HB 25, which is the insurance coverage for contraceptives bill. And so we will figure out when we will be bringing that up again. Sorry to the folks who wanted to testify on this, and we will set aside public testimony. We'll figure that out. So at this time, House Finance will be adjourned, and the time is 4:13 p.m. Thank you.